Hello, this is Jay Sperling Reich, producer of the Showbiz Sandbox podcast. Before we begin this week's episode, I wanted to take a moment and ask for your help in getting Showbiz Sandbox nominated for a 2013 podcast award. The nomination process is fairly easy and should take just a minute or two. Simply visit podcastawards.com and in the form provided, enter Showbiz Sandbox in two categories, the People's Choice category and the Entertainment category. The only information you need to enter is the podcast name, which of course is Showbiz Sandbox, and our website URL, which is www.showbizsandbox.com. They also ask for your name and email address, though they only use it to ensure you're not voting more than once. So again, help Showbiz Sandbox win a 2013 podcast award by nominating us at podcastawards.com. That's podcastawards.com. Thanks for all your help and continuing to listen. Without further delay, here's this week's episode. For the week of October 6th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 208. The podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wait, so you're in New York?
Yeah.
Interesting. So I'm a little surprised then why you never told me that you were actually Banksy, the underground...
Shit!
Oh, was I not supposed to mention this? You're not...
No.
Because when I saw that movie, Exit Through the Gift Shop, about
very
the underground,
creepy.
Very good documentary about this artist from the UK, who's a graffiti artist, and all of his work now sells for millions of dollars. And apparently he is now doing a 30-day, one-month show during the month of October in New York. He's doing a residency in New York where he's apparently spray-painting the walls of New York.
That's right. If you go to his blog, which I guess we'll have a link to, or at least the New York Times story, it tells you where that day's piece has appeared. So there's one in Chinatown. There's one in Chelsea. One he did on the back of a truck. And so that truck's been moving around the city. That's very cool. So you find out where they are, and then you go search them out and check them out, look at them. So that's very cool. It's a nice, fun sort of pop-up art exhibit.
And what I really like is the first one was of two children spray painting over a sign that said, graffiti is a crime.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm sure... For those of you who are wondering, gee, who is this Banksy guy? If you haven't seen Exit Through the Gift Shop, I'm sure you've seen his work. And if you want to see more of it, you can go to his website, banksy.co.uk. Michael, you have a website, of course, bookfilter.com, and you write for the Huffington Post and others.
And I'm on at michaelgiltz.com. That's right.
That's true. And, you know, we have a website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you can find ways to follow us on Twitter. We're at showbizsandbox. Of course, we're on Facebook. Just look up Showbiz Sandbox and you can like us there. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher, the Microsoft Marketplace, wherever they give podcasts away for free. Or you could email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com or call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. In fact, on today's show, we're going to expand on our conversation regarding the South Korean box office. Remember last week we were talking about it?
I do. And I know Banksy's a fan of the show. He probably loves South Korean films. But what else will he be hearing about this week?
Well, the reason I mentioned all of those ways to contact us is because we're going to be talking about the South Korean box office in part thanks to some recent media stories, but also some added insight from one of our listeners out of South Korea. We've got some more information to share with you, and we'll go over it in just a moment. We have a few updates on some theater stories we've been tracking, including one on Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. You know, I threw that whole
keep going
thing. Yeah, okay. In any case, we'll conclude by trying to figure out what the heck is going on with all the big executive shakeups at Hollywood movie studios these days. What do they mean, and why are they happening? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we, of course, talk about movies around the world, not just North America. We're talking about the box office and the entire world all added up. The number one movie around the world, no surprise, it is Gravity. This film grossed $82 million, I should say $83 million worldwide. It had a huge opening in North America. It grossed $55 million. It's the highest grossing October debut of all time. So worldwide, $83 million, a very strong start. It's in 28 territories. This looks like one of the big hits of the year. There's a lot of things to talk about this movie. I guess the most interesting is the 3D breakdown. We've been talking for about 3 years now about how audiences have rejected 3D and are slowly migrating away from it. But we've always said, hey, whenever a big movie comes out, it's not that it will be gone forever. The big movie, the right movie, like Avatar 2 or say The Hobbit or something like Gravity, where it's a sci-fi, it's a science-based movie set in space. It was made with care and everybody talks about the 3D as being positive part of the film. When that happens and all the planets align, it's a good movie. Everybody likes the 3D. Yes, people will turn out for 3D, but they've never turned out in this number before. 80% of the revenue from Gravity came from 3D ticket sales in North America. That may be the highest ever. Avatar only did 72%. That's how big this number is. 80% of all the money was made from 3D and especially 3D IMAX because people love the IMAX too. It wasn't shot in IMAX. Most of the screens that you saw it in IMAX weren't in fact IMAX screens. Nonetheless, people said it was a really good presentation in 3D and on IMAX. It made 20% of its total box office from IMAX. That's a huge number. So you're looking at $55 million, and a big chunk of that, most of it, the vast majority, came from 3D. Is that, does that mean people are saying they love 3D? They want more 3D? Is that what it means, Sperling?
No, I think really what's happening here is when Avatar was released, everybody thought, look, this could be a huge movie. And James Cameron went on a campaign shortly before the movie opened, the year the movie opened, and he started showing footage, and everybody looked at the footage. They looked at the 3D, all these exhibitors and these, you know, the people who actually sell the equipment and the 3D systems, and said, oh my goodness, this looks amazing. This movie's going to be huge. We need to install 3D as soon as possible. And so they started to install 3D probably about a year out. However, it was not nearly as...
But there weren't enough 3D screens around right. For it to be even bigger. It could have been bigger. Avatar 2 may break this record. The point is, though, they thought it was the beginning of every movie was going to be 3D. All the big movies were going to be 3D. Every animated film has been in 3D for a while now, practically. Lots of big summer blockbusters have been in 3D, but that number is falling because audiences don't want to see most movies in 3D.
Well, family films, in all fairness to family films, you know, when I take kids to see a movie, an animated film, I don't want to pay the extra for.
Well, of course, there's lots of reasons why it's not working. It's pointless. Half the time it's done poorly. People don't want to pay the extra money. Little kids hate the glasses.
Right.
For all these reasons, the effect of Gravity is not, oh my gosh, we're wrong. 3D is going to be bigger than ever. It's just, this is the exception that proves the rule.
I've never really understood what that whole phrase meant, but I'm going to agreement.
When you find an example that's counter to the rule that you've established, you say, well, that stands out and that's notable because it's the exception. And so you say, okay, I found that one exception, but 99 times out of 100, the opposite is true. Therefore, you know that that one exception sticks out and we all remember it because it's the exception that proves the rule. Does that make sense?
Gesundheit.
No? Okay. Well, that is the number one movie around the world. It was huge. I saw it. I thought it was fine. It was okay. I thought it was a pretty good B movie sort of thrill ride. If you see it once, I don't think you need to see it again. I saw it in 3D. I wasn't wildly impressed. I thought it was well-made 3D, but I think I would have been perfectly happy to see it in 2D. I don't think you'd lose a thing. And frankly, I saw 2001, A Space Odyssey, just a few weeks ago. The special effects in that movie look just as good. The sense of being in space and staring above the Earth is just as vivid and dramatic. I don't think the 3D adds a damn thing except a few bolts floating around in space. Who cares? It added nothing to me. I didn't think, oh my God, I'm in space. You know, it did nothing of that for me. And the people I was with felt the same way. It was well done 3D, but not emotionally or dramatically important in any way, shape, or form. But it is well done. If you see it in 3D, it's at least a satisfying experience as opposed to most movies.
You know, I haven't seen the full film. I've seen numerous segments shown during different conferences, trade shows, or demonstrations. And what I saw of it was fantastic. The 3D was definitely above par. Now, you mentioned 2001, A Space Odyssey. A lot of people are looking at this film shot mostly with real objects, not CGI. And they're saying, look, you know, you can only do so much with CGI. Is Gravity saying, look, you need to go back to having real objects and real material in your films, not just computer animation?
Well, we said that a week or two ago about this disastrous left turn we took with digital effects. And somebody said, hey, it's how you use it and the way you use it. That's absolutely true. But the fact is, you look at the Lord of the Rings trilogy, that actually looked like a real place. Then you look at The Hobbit, it looks like junk.
Yes.
It looks faker. It's just like the Star Wars prequels. They've, whatever direction they've gone in artistically, it looks less convincing. And there's something in your mind's eye, I think, where you see a digital effect that's all digitally created as opposed to a model that's being shot and lit and digital effects added to it. Something in your mind's eye knows you're not looking at a physical object and it registers differently. I'm speaking in very banal, basic terms, but I just have to believe when it's a physical object that's being filmed, it somehow registers in a more convincing way than something created on, you know, on a computer screen.
I would agree with that, and I've always agreed with that.
Yeah, I mean, 2001 looks fantastic. Gravity, if Gravity gets people to go back to using more models because it works better for convincing stuff, great. I thought it was a pretty fun movie. It's making a ton of money. I guess it'll be in the Oscar race, though I can't imagine. I guess one of 10 movies. But to my mind, it's not one of the best films of the year, not even close. It doesn't deserve comparison with 2001 or some of the other movies that it's been compared to. But, you know, it's a perfectly, for a Hollywood studio film, it's like a breath of fresh air. It didn't suck. I was thrilled. Number two around the world is Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2. $30 million worldwide. So it's the second weekend in North America. It held pretty well. It's doing pretty good, and it's got a wide open berth for family films for quite a few weeks. So it should have good, strong legs. It's at $71 million worldwide and counting. And number three around the world is Young Detective D, the sequel to the last Detective D movie. I should say prequel. It's called Young Detective D, Rise of the Sea Dragon. And it grossed another, where are we at now? $19.5 million. So it's at $71 million and counting. This is a hugely successful franchise. I'm not quite sure why they made a prequel rather than a sequel, but it certainly paid off.
Because they wanted to be, this is a film from China, they wanted to be the exact opposite of the U.S., which only makes sequels.
So it cost, the first one, Detective D, cost $13 million to make and made $52 million worldwide. Now, that doesn't include anything from North America. They made like a few $100,000. Nobody saw it here. Young Detective D cost $20 million to make, and it's already at $71 million. So it's already doing substantially better than the first one. So this series is going to be around for a while. We'll have to see if it opens in North America, whether they can get on our radar and get people to come see this movie. But a very successful worldwide franchise. And I think we'll be seeing about this movie and this series for years to come.
Well, now there's a point I should underscore here. There are more theaters in China now than there were, movie theaters, I mean, than there were when the first film opened. So that helps the gross a little bit.
It was like, what, 3 years ago?
I don't know. I'm just saying, you know, there are reasons for this.
Well,
plus, everybody saw the pirated version, and now they want to see the prequel.
The first version came out 3 years ago. It wasn't exactly 30 years ago.
I know. I'm just saying. Right. But even 3 years ago, there were fewer screens in China than there are today, and significantly fewer.
All right. You're saying the first one would have made just as much money if there'd been more theaters?
Oh, no, I can't say that. I'm just saying, you know, one thing to keep in mind is,
because you don't need 40,000 screens to make a ton of money.
No.
Right. You know, we've learned that. Once you get past about 1,500 screens in North America, you're just gaining incremental amounts of box office. Everything above 1,500 is just for bragging rights. And number four around the world is Runner Runner, a Justin Timberlake, Ben Affleck thriller. It grossed $15 million now that it's opened up in the U.S. It opened up overseas to start. Now it's at $31 million and counting. Terrible reviews for this one, so it should probably fall fast. And number five, Insidious Chapter 2, a horror film. Another $13 million. It passed the $100 million mark. And number six, Ron Howard's Rush. It's sort of an interesting movie. It's made $12 million this weekend. It's at $50 million and counting. It's certainly doing a lot better overseas where people know Formula One racing. So, I mean, that's a good sign, right? That's where you need to make the money, because people in the U.S. just don't know or care about Formula One. That's what they feel like. I feel like, well, hey, it's racing. People understand that. It's not complicated. You know, they're in a car and they try to cross the finish line first. They act like Formula One is some, you know, unknown entity to us. To me, it seems pretty basic. But they made it for a very inexpensive amount of money, $38 million. I assume that doesn't include Ron Howard's cut. The stars are not big names where they'd get a big cut.
Chris Hemsworth, and Daniel Brühl.
Yeah, and Daniel Brühl, who's a terrific actor. So this is a movie made on a dime. We assume Ron Howard made it very inexpensively because it was a passion project. It's already grossed $50 million. We'll have to see where it ends up. But if they get to $100 million, depending on how his deal is structured, looks like they could be into profitability. At number seven around the world is Prisoners, the Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal drama. Another $11 million. It's at $62 million and counting. At number eight, still chugging along, is Turbo. Another $10 million. It's at $194 million. If it can get to $300 million, we'll be talking profitability.
And
number nine is The Lone Ranger, another $7 million. And at number 10, a movie I'm not even sure what it is. It's called Inferno 3D. It grossed $6.5 million. It opened in seven territories. I think it might be an Eli Roth horror film, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
I tried to figure out what it is, where it's from, who made it, but I couldn't nail that down. So we're still looking for word on that. In North America, we have some more news. Pulling Strings is a Spanglish comedy from the same company that released Instructions Not Included. It's about a mariachi singer, and it made $2.5 million on just 387 screens. One of the best per screen averages on the market. Not the best, but one of the best ones, certainly in that many screens, right behind Gravity. So it was a good, solid launch for this movie. It pales in comparison to Instructions Not Included, but hey, that's a one-in-a-lifetime extravaganza as far as box office is concerned. And also, just below this list from Rentrack, we have Met Opera Live. This is the new season of the Met Opera. They show them in theaters around the world so people can see these performances live while they're happening. This was Eugene Onegin. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It grossed, I think, about $3.9 million worldwide. That's a very rough estimate. In the U.S., it made $2 million, and another 108,000 people saw it overseas. That's according to the exhibitor. Using that figure, I figure, well, 100,000 people, they probably paid about $20 each to see it because this is premium-priced entertainment. So by that figure, it could be anywhere from $3 to $4 million.
Wait, where are you getting all these figures from? You said the exhibitor mentioned this?
Well, they mentioned that it grossed $1.9 million in North America. And then they said another 108,000 people paid to watch it overseas. So in theaters around the world, like the UK, they do this. They have the Met Opera Live.
Oh, believe me, I know. This is my business.
Right. So at 108,000 people overseas, I thought, well, how much did they gross from that 108,000 people? And I thought, well, maybe they were able to get about $20 US. Maybe that's high, maybe that's low. Like I said, it's a very rough estimate. Maybe you can tell me whether I'm even close.
Yeah, I don't know. And they have not been very forthcoming with
They should be, because they want people to know it's a success. And they want to encourage more people to do live programming like this. So they should trumpet stuff when it works. This is like the eighth year they've been doing this with the Met. So clearly they're making some money, or they wouldn't keep doing it.
This is the most successful alternative content programming.
Well, that may be a very low bar.
But I mean,
want to let people know it's a success and let them know that alternative programming pulls in good money, then they should be delivering as much information as they can so people know exactly how well it's doing.
What you're saying is they should be promoting the category of alternative content. I agree.
Yeah. And well done on that list from Rentrack. We go down to number 18 or 19. There's a couple other movies, including Wish. This movie grossed, how much did it gross?
I don't know. I wish I knew.
Where did it disappear to? Oh, I guess it's below the top 18. It's another South Korean film that debuted in South Korea pretty strongly. Because that theater is on fire. And we're really lucky to have Rentrack. This is where we get our worldwide box office figures. It's not perfect, but it's a pretty good gathering place where you can get a lot of information about movies from around the world. And there's a new person in a job there at Rentrack, isn't there?
Yeah, Paul DeGarabedian. He's joining them as their senior media analyst. And of course, he was with Hollywood.com. And for years, he worked at Exhibitor Relations, which he then left to found Media by Numbers, which was then purchased by Hollywood.com.
Has he been a guest on the show?
Yes, he has.
Yeah, that's right. I thought he had. I mean, if you're in the business, you see his name constantly. And he's also quoted in the media quite a lot. He's on TV and radio and print, constantly talking about the box office and what it means and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, you sort of can track who's the big dog on box office grosses by seeing where Paul goes to work.
Yeah.
It was Exhibitor Relations for quite a while. Then he started his own business. They got bought out, and now he's moved over to Rentrack.
Yes. Well, and they got bought out because Hollywood.com wanted somebody who could speak knowledgeably about box office. And now Rentrack is saying, hey, we're an industry player. We are an industry company, and we're kind of business to business, but we're becoming more of a Nielsen, and we need a front-facing person. Let's get Paul.
Could have called us.
Yeah. What's the deal? Come on, Rentrack.
But good. I mean, he's the guy you want. So good for him. So that's the worldwide box office. A couple little smaller numbers or smaller things in local markets. Japan. The film Like Father, Like Son, I think we talked about it on the show.
Yes, we did because it was in Cannes. I saw it in Cannes. It was a very good movie by Kurieda.
I liked it. I thought it was a solid film, a little sentimental, but I liked it.
Yes, it was very sentimental. That's true.
Definitely commercial. Well, it's opened in Japan on 309 screens, and it made $3.2 million, which makes it the number one movie in Japan for that weekend. And it's off to a very good start. It looks like it'll be his biggest commercial hit in that country ever.
That's right. Now let's talk for a second about it premiered in Cannes, and this year on the jury and heading the jury really was Steven Spielberg, filmmaker Steven Spielberg, who also is a part of another company called DreamWorks. And now
you make it sound like a plot.
No.
Saw the movie in Cannes, he liked it, and they bought the remake rights. They're going to make this movie in English.
Yes, I was just trying to tell a story, turn the news into a story. Keep our listeners engaged.
There is a little bit of a story on The Hobbit, because when we talk about movies and whether they're profitable...
You think that's a little story? I mean, come on, they're turning it into three movies. Apparently, there's enough of a story there for, like, you know, a trilogy.
Not really. But anyway, it's very hard for us to talk about when is a movie profitable. It depends. We don't know what the P&A is. We don't always know the budget. They like to lowball the budget or highball the budget, depending on what their agenda is. They want to make it sound big and splashy, they highball the budget. They want to make it sound like they're being really responsible and making movies on a dime, they lowball the budget. So it's really hard for us to determine what the actual budget is of a movie and when it's going to hit profitability. We do the best we can based on the information available. Well, guess what? On the Hobbit trilogy, we have a lot of information.
And that's because they left a trail of financial breadcrumbs.
Whoops!
Yeah. And so they've spent about $561 million so far, according to The Hollywood Reporter, and frankly, according to all of these organizations that are tracking how much money is being spent in the New Zealand economy. You know,
they formed a company in New Zealand when they made The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And a company to get local benefits and all that sort of stuff. And they do that for almost every movie, technically, don't they?
Yes.
Almost every movie is its own company.
That's right. So, that way, you're suing
You're not suing Warner Brothers, you're suing
right.
Joe Blow. And yet you are suing Warner Brothers. So they did that for The Lord of the Rings. They maintained it for The Hobbit. They had to file some financial documents. And we have a very detailed list of the money they've spent on this movie. And it's $561 million, almost literally double, what the Lord of the Rings trilogy cost. And they're not done yet.
Yes. Well, here's the thing with that, as far as it being double. They were unsure of the Lord of the Rings. Will it be a success or will it fall flat on its face? So they spent $250 million to make all three films at the same time. A ton of money. Correct.
Don't make it sound like they were penny pinching.
No.
It was one of the biggest gambles of all time. It was New Line Cinema. It was three movies being made at once. No one had ever done that before.
That's right. It was a huge
gamble.
Still
hasn't done it since, I don't think, all three movies until The Hobbit.
Right.
And that wasn't even decided. So that is a huge gamble. I mean, it's an expensive, you know, franchise pillar type movie where you're going to spend a lot of money on one of them. But that was a massive, massive big gamble.
Kind of like when you have, you know, $100 in your pocket and you go, oh, I could buy that. It's only $5. Well, you say that enough and all of a sudden you have $561 million in your budget.
Right. So this second trilogy is twice as expensive, but hey, they know what they're getting. The first one came out, it grossed $1 billion. So if they make $3 billion at the box office, that will be $650 million or whatever they end up at, you know, well spent.
Yes.
They'll be grossing five times their budget. And any movie that does that, God help you if you can't be profitable then.
Yeah, and just a little follow-up on a story we talked about last week, or at least a subject we talked about. We talked about Don John, right?
Mm-hmm.
And The Hollywood Reporter had a headline, Don John Shrinkage, Relativity Suffers Box Office Cold Streak. And they went through all of their films for the year. And I guess they're saying, look, because of that $25 million P&A budget that they guaranteed to the film, Don John, which they picked up at Sundance, the fact that it made $9 million in its first week, it'll probably top out at 20. They'll probably lose money on this. I still don't think they will lose money on this, in my opinion.
Why is that?
I think that it may have some word of mouth. I mean, it's a fairly fun film, and I think certainly on video, it's going to do quite well. Theatrically, it may break even. I don't think they're going to lose money.
What do you think they have to make to do that?
Well, I think they probably need to make about $30 million.
That's what we said before, right?
Right, correct.
Well, $30 million gross, but they've spent $30 million on it, and you think they need to make back what
they... Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah. Yeah, that's true. I was thinking 30 million gross. They'll make 15. Yeah, you're right. There's no way for them to make money. They're screwed. Unless they release it in South Korea.
That's right. And of course, if you've been listening to the show, we talk about South Korea a lot. And of course, we talk about a lot of stories over and over again because they're continuing stories like 3D and South Korea and China, because those are big, important global markets for the box office. And other outlets are starting to catch up, aren't they, Sperling?
Yes. Now, it looks like, I guess, what, there's a story in Variety.
Two stories. In The Hollywood Reporter.
Right. And they're talking.
Oh, no. Sorry. It is Variety. Yeah. Two stories in Variety.
Yeah. That saying that South Korea is, I guess, going undergoing a new golden age in cinema, and that they have sold 100 million tickets for local fare in the fastest time in history, on track for a record year. Total ticket sales also are setting a record in terms of, you know, money coming in. Local films are about 60% of the market there. And big hits include Miracle in Cell Number 7. I'd love to see what that movie's about. It's made $84 million locally. And Snowpiercer, of course, we've talked about. It's made $61 million locally.
I know what Miracle in Cell Number 7 is about.
Really?
It sounds heartwarming. It sounds like Hollywood's going to remake it in like 5 minutes. It's about a mentally challenged man. It's a heartwarming comedy. A mentally challenged man gets thrown into jail wrongfully for murder, which he didn't do. And all the other hardened inmates, they soften up when they see this lovable guy. He wins them all over. And then they break his daughter into jail so he can visit with her again. Doesn't it just sound like a Hollywood movie ready to go?
So it's Prison Break In.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. I don't think the little girl has a tattoo on her body, but you get the idea.
Okay. Yes. Now that is a Fox Prison Break reference.
That's right.
But, you know, here's the interesting thing. We talked the other week, I think a week or two ago, about The Face Reader, which is a film that's doing quite well in South Korea. And we were wondering why in its second or third week, why is it going up in its second week and then back down in its third week box office wise? And it turns out Yoon Ha Choi, one of our listeners in South Korea, has an answer for us.
Yes, right. I'm so glad that he wrote into us because I'm not on top of my South Korean holidays. But anyway, I hope we're saying his name right. But he says, hey, Showbiz Sandbox. Hi, I am Yoon Ha Choi, writing in from Seoul, Korea. I work in the entertainment industry over here at a company called CJ Entertainment and Media, and I'm a big fan of your show. The Korean film industry is a solid one. Domestic films drawn as much as or even more audiences than Hollywood blockbusters. Exactly, as we just said, they actually pull in 60% of total ticket sales. He goes on to say, The Face Reader is the most recent local hit, following other hits such as Snowpiercer, The Terror Live, and Hide and Seek, all of which have been introduced on your show at some point during the past few weeks in the worldwide top 15 chart. Factoring in the fact that the South Korean population is only 50 million, Korean films ranking the top 15 on a worldwide chart is an amazing feat. Koreans love domestic films, especially dramas and period pieces, and The Face Reader fits right in that category. The reason why the box office score for that film shot up in the second weekend after opening and then falling back down in the third is because that second week fell into our version of Thanksgiving holidays, also known as Chuseok, which is one of two major holidays in Korea. The Face Reader dominated the whole half-week-long holiday season, and it's now crossed the 8 million attendance mark. That's tickets sold, bums on the paid seats, which is how we gauge the box office trend over here, and is still going strong. Considering the biggest Korean film in industry history is The Thieves, with just under 13 million attendance, The Reader is establishing itself as a major hit, not just this autumn, but also in Korean film history. So there you have it. A market with favorable tendencies towards local movies and the holiday factor were behind The Face Reader's impressive box office life cycle. Best, Yoon Ha. Well, great. I appreciate him reading it, you know, calling in and explaining to us what was going on there. I love that Korea tracks ticket sales.
Yes.
I only wish Hollywood had been doing that since the 30s. Oh, my God. My heart flutters at the idea of knowing how many tickets the Gone with the Wind actually sold. That would be so great. It's the best way to compare movies from year to year and era to era. And gosh, I wish we had that info available. So that's very cool.
We do have information available for Gone with the Wind. I believe the figure is lots and lots.
That's right. And what's the other big story that's breaking into the mainstream media? I mean, Variety, of course, is an industry paper, so people are probably a little bit aware, but they made a big point of talking about South Korean box office.
And the fact that, you know, some of their local fare, some of the indigenous productions, as they're known in the industry, are being made by this wave of talented young directors. So there's going to be more films and the local box office is dominating, unlike in many countries where Hollywood fare dominates.
Well, you want local box office to be good. You want local film to be vibrant because, you know, Hollywood studios co-produce some of those films. those filmmakers cross over into Hollywood, and a healthy local box office means it's more likely to have, you know, a strong box office long term. It's just better for everyone. You don't want Hollywood to be crushing the local film industry. You want them to work side by side. You get your local fare, you got your Hollywood fare. It's a better mix.
Well, you know, in Spain, it's 85% Hollywood and 15% local indigenous, you know, Spanish.
And that's bad. And Hollywood should not say, oh, that's great, we're crushing them. They should say, we want more Pedro Almodovar's. We want more, you know, other talented Spanish filmmakers to cross over. And we want to do what we can to try and encourage that industry.
Yeah, you want to be a global category, not just a domestic category that gets exported. Is what you're saying. And by the way, CJ Entertainment is a pretty big company in Korea. It is a film production company and distribution company and has movie theaters as well. It's a pretty well-known movie theater group. I'd really like to thank Yoon-ha. It just goes to show you how great our listeners are. Yoon-ha wrote into dirt@showbizsandbox.com, and you can too. We'd love to hear from you.
Yes, let's hear from someone in China. Because
that would
be great. Talk about China a lot. We love the people of China and their culture. The government, of course, Hollywood has some issues with. And Rolling Stone caught up with that story. They did a big article in Rolling Stone magazine about Hollywood and Beijing butting heads.
Yeah, you know, when I first saw you put this story in our rundown, I thought, why are we even discussing this? We've talked about all of these things before. The fact that Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained was released in theaters and then pulled and had to be recut. And when it was finally released a month or two later, it kind of
bombed. Nobody cared.
Yeah, that there's a quota, that there was this 2% tariff that they wanted to place, you know, the value-added tax they wanted to place on imported movies, all of which come from Hollywood. And so basically it was, you know, a 2% tax on Hollywood movie. All of this stuff we've talked about. So why are we covering this story again? But then I realized, wait a second, you know what? Actually, this is a story that's appearing, even though it's kind of a rehash of everything we've discussed on Showbiz Sandbox. It's appearing in Rolling Stone, which is a general interest or music magazine.
Right. So to know that people all around the country now are starting to become aware of Hollywood box office and the growing cinema in China and the growing importance it is, that's a fascinating trend. It's
yes.
Not the fact that they've broke new ground, but just the fact that they're telling everybody else about what we and Hollywood has been speaking about for months or years now.
Yeah. Now, you also are asking in the notes here, a thought experiment that I do not understand at all.
Well, let me just put it this way. Everyone in Hollywood is afraid to stand up to China and demand sort of better terms. China will only allow X number of movies in their country, and you only get, at best, 25% of the box office gross back out of the country and into your coffers.
Right, and the number of films, by the way, is 34. It used to be 20. It's now 34 films per year that are not just from the U.S., but foreign. So imported films, 34, that's it. They have a quota.
Right. The vast majority, of course, are U.S.
All of them are.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. They could be from another country, but they're all U.S. I
yes.
assume there will be a James Bond film or some film that maybe is British or French that they'll want at some point.
Yes.
Right. So my point is they're afraid to stand up to them because the box office is growing by leaps and bounds. It's such an important market. They're bending over backwards. They're letting China treat them like an abused wife. You know, they're just taking the beating and keep on going and don't say anything. And I think they really need to stand up now because 2 years from now, 5 years from now, it's going to cost a lot more to stand up to China. Right now, if you lose out on taking your movie to China, say it would have grossed $100 million, you lose $25 million, right?
Yes.
3 years from now, you'll be losing $50 million because it might make $200 million, right? But, so the money you're going to leave aside, the money you're going to set aside by refusing to bring your film to China till you get better terms is going to grow dramatically. So I feel like the time to stand up now, the time to say, you need our movies just as much as we need you, and you're going to want these movies in your box office. You want to feed the beast that you've created. You want your middle-class population of 300-400 million people to not complain and say, why can't we see the new Marvel Avengers movie? Why can't we see the new Avatar? Why can't we see the new this or that? They're going to get angry. The children of politicians will say, Dad, you're such an idiot. Why can't I go see this movie? You know, all that stuff will happen whenever you do it. Now is the time to to fight back. Now is the time to demand better terms because they need your movies just as much as you need them. And frankly, it will cost you more money to fight back 3 years from now. Do it now while the box office is smaller.
You know, these kinds of business relationships, they go through cycles and there's like a pattern to them. And I think really the stage they're at now is they're realizing, and by they, I mean Hollywood studios, they like the money. They see all this money coming out and they're like, okay, well, we can take 25% because it's 25% we weren't getting before. And you know, there's no piracy anymore, and they're building a lot of theaters over there. And even though local fare, indigenous productions are still, predominant, and we own a smaller stake of the market, exhibition-wise, theatrically.
They're thinking short term.
We want that 25%.
Right, they're thinking
short term. And they're trying to figure out right now, okay, the rules are really hard over in China, and they keep changing, and nothing's written down, and so what worked in February doesn't work in May, but whatever, let's try and figure out a way to work with China, so let's set up joint co-productions, or let's make sure the content is China-friendly, and that's where they're at right now today. I think what you're talking about will occur. It probably will occur in that 5-year time span where they begin to go, you know what, this is just too difficult. But
it's going to be a lot harder to pull away and not bring your films to China when you could make, you know, 4 times as much money.
Yes. Now,
even though your percentage is just as poor. The fact is, what happens to the Chinese box office or any box office if you say we're not going to give you our films because your terms suck?
Well, a couple of things, right? And it always depends on the country.
They've got all these movie theaters. They get 70. Your movie makes $100 million. It grosses $100 million. They get $75 million. Suddenly, they don't have that $75 million. It's not a given that they're going to make that money no matter what movie they put out there.
Right.
You know?
What you're saying
they need big Hollywood movies. So they're losing $75 million. You're thinking, oh, no, I can't lose my $25 million. Guess what? They're losing $75 million because it's not a zero-sum game. If you don't get the Avengers, you're never going to get that money. You can't just put in, you know, Turbo and get the same amount of money as you'd get from the Avengers.
Do you think that their indigenous, you know, Chinese productions would not make $75 to $100 million? Is that...
Of course they can make... Right. We talked about Detective D 2 seconds ago.
Right.
Of course they can make successful films, but that doesn't replace... It's not, oh, I can't eat the hamburger, so I'm going to have that other hamburger. They're a unique product every single time. Making a hit film is not an assembly line. It's not a shoe. So
right,
if you don't have the Avatar, you can't replace that with something else. If you don't have The Hobbit Part 2 and The Hobbit Part 3, there's not another thing you can slot into its place. Well, this is a movie. That'll make just as much money. Of course not.
Well, in the political system there, what they're trying to prevent is basically people, you know, the population and the citizens of China just going to see the American movies. They want them to see...
That's
lovable. Movies.
That's not what they're doing. That's not. They're just screwing Hollywood over because they can. Nobody wants to see the local film industry be smothered. They're working with them left and right. They're doing 1 million co-productions. They're bringing animation outlets there. They're making movies there. They're doing everything to work with them. So that's not the point.
Yeah,
they're
but on their terms. They're doing everything to work with them on China's terms.
Right, right.
Well, and what I was going to finish up that thought with Hollywood is, of course, trying to get their foothold in there to make sure that there is a culture of seeing American movies as well as Chinese movies. And they don't want to be left out of as that culture grows, they don't want to be left out.
Are you really worried that they won't be in the habit of wanting to see Hollywood movies?
No. I mean, unless something changes, my prediction of that 5-year time frame was unless something changes, and something very well might change. We'll see.
Right. Well, I think it's hard to get profitable. So the better terms you get, there's no reason to let one big market give you dramatically worse terms than any other market. Nothing to do with China. It's just to do France, Japan, Spain. Doesn't matter. Why are you letting them give you radically poorer terms than any other market in the world? Doesn't make sense to me. You're losing money.
Yeah, and it's all about size. They believe that there's a hope. Oh, we're going to make so much money there. There's a hope. And so because of that hope, and because it's the whale, as you know, is mentioned often. They want to try and work with them, and I think
the whale.
You know, it's a big giant treasure trove there. There's like a billion plus people. We can make so much money there that hope will make so much money. Let's figure out a way to work with the Chinese. Well, I think at some point they're going to find out, like in any other market, gee, it's really hard to work when we have all of these constraints.
Well, it's really hard to make money on Broadway, too. So we've talked a lot about box office. Let's talk about Broadway box office.
I don't think it's hard to make money on Broadway at all. Just ask the folks who made Kinky Boots. They made their money back.
I guess I was wrong not to invest in them. Remember, we did that at the beginning of the year. We said, what shows would Michael invest in? Kinky Boots, I said, no. I love Cyndi Lauper. I like Harvey Fierstein. I've heard the song and I hated it. I don't like the movie. I just can't bring myself to invest in it. I'd already be making money if I'd done it.
Yes, that's right. And how many weeks, though? After 30 weeks, they've earned their budget.
For Broadway, you had to go profitable in 30 weeks to recoup your budget, which was $13.5 million. Pretty solid, big budget for Broadway. That's a very, very fast track. I mean, it won 6 Tonys, including Best Musical and Best Score. It's really turned itself into a big Broadway hit. This week, the numbers have just come out like 2 minutes ago. It grossed $1.6 million over last week. So it's the third highest grossing show on Broadway. Its gross potential is well over 100%. It's sold out at the box office. So it is definitely the big kahuna from last season.
So, yeah, and really, the undertones of what you're saying is that the Tonys don't matter. They don't help you get a new, you know, they don't help you find an audience. Exactly.
Oh, you mean, no. Winning Best Musical is the one Tony that does matter. It's not a given. Just because you win Best Musical doesn't mean you're going to work. You know, Motown the Musical, I don't know that that would be bigger than Kinky Boots. Motown the Musical grossed $1.4 million. It's at like 98% gross. It's almost completely sold out. It's been doing great since the day it opened. But Kinky Boots has passed it by, and it does have the Tony stamp of Best Musical. Motown has a lot of classic songs people know already. So, you know, you don't need the Tony to win, but it can certainly help. And Kinky Boots needed it more than Motown, and it has certainly capitalized on it for the time being. But it's kind of fascinating. They say, hey, we've recouped our money. We've made back our budget, which then leads us to say, well, all right, let's look at the numbers. Kinky Boots has grossed about $41 million since opening in March. If you minus the budget of $13.5 million that they announced, that means they have netted $27.5 million. Well, obviously, it costs money to put on a show every week. You don't ever stop spending money on a Broadway show because you got performers there and crew and backstage people. So that's called the weekly nut. Unlike a movie, you got to pay to put on a show every week. So there's a weekly nut, and people would love to know what that is. That tells you a lot about how much a show costs, what it costs to put it on. Spider-Man's been widely reported as having one of the highest nuts in history, $1 million per week to put on that show. So I wonder what Kinky Boots cost.
Now, I wonder, do we have to bleep out all these nuts or no?
No.
That's allowed?
No.
Okay, just that's checking.
Right. So it's had 240 performances. It's had 30 weeks. So that's where you figure out the performances, the weeks, the amount of money they made, and how quickly they got back their budget. Put in all the numbers, figure it all out. That means it probably costs them about $750,000 a week to put on Kinky Boots. Because when you add that up over 30 weeks, and then you subtract the money that they've grossed and all that, you figure out, well, that's how they get to about, you know, where they're at, the $13.5 million in profits.
Now, to all of that, I just say, Gesundheit.
Yeah, I got into Sperling land, didn't I, with all my numbers. I think over 30 weeks, it cost them about $26 million to put on the show in weekly costs. That means if you gross $41 million and it costs you $26 million to make, that's how you get your $14 million back.
This math you're speaking of, does it require numbers?
I'm sorry. Well, they really like to talk about their budget. They really like to talk about how much it costs to put on a show every week. So when they talk about how quickly they made their money back, you can do a little math on the back of an envelope and figure out about what it costs to put on that show every week. Of course, Spider-Man has been widely reported as costing...
Wait a second. Don't you mean Spider-Man? Turn off the dark.
That's exactly what I mean. That costs about $1 million a week to put on. That's why it's been out all this year, and all year long it was grossing, you know, 1.2, 1.1, 1.3 million, a million, 960,000, on and on. It all year long in 2000, up until September, it only netted about $5.8 million. Even though it's been making over $1 million at the week, it costs so much to put on, you're only making like 100,000 or 120,000 or 50,000. You know, in comparison, Kinky Boots grossed 1.6 million last week. That means it netted about $900,000. That's added into the coffers. That's, you know, it costs $750,000 to put on. It grosses 1.6. You got $700,000 in the bank. That's a lot of profit. Spider-Man, on the other hand, has been barely breaking even all year long. It took them 9 months to net about $5.8 million. And suddenly, out of nowhere, it has collapsed.
But you mean the $5.8 million has collapsed?
Well, it's certainly gone down. I'm saying the money that they're making at the box office has collapsed. They barely got to $1 million a week. And now suddenly, I don't know why, I don't know what's happening, but it's taken a dramatic spill. First, it was grossing about $1 million for like 3 or 4 weeks.
Which we think is their nut. We think that that's about right. How much it costs to put on, which means they're breaking even on those weeks.
Right. Then it dropped to $790,000.
Which means
then
they're probably losing money those weeks.
No, they're definitely losing $210,000 based on our estimate. Then they dropped to $730,000. Then they dropped to $718,000. Then they dropped to $620,000. I mean, it's just gone into free fall.
So it's kind of like watching an American football game where somebody goes on a run and it's the 50-yard line, the 40-yard line, yeah. The 30, the 20.
Except it's bad or okay. You're on the other team.
Okay.
Last week, this week, the numbers just came out. It ticked up just a tad to $650,000. Almost every show increased this week, so it's not a surprise it would go up a little bit. You know, we're getting into the fall season. But if it grossed $650,000 and it costs $1 million to put on, that means it lost $350,000 this week. Now, this show is the highest, most expensive Broadway show in history. It costs like $75 million to put it on. And now this year, all year long, they just almost were able to gross about, I mean, to net about $6 million. And now that's collapsed to almost $4 million. So they're losing money week after week, minute after minute. I don't see how much longer they can, if this continues, they got to pull the plug.
Well, you know, I think one production.
They lost over $1 million in 4 weeks. Now they're up to $1.4 million in 5 weeks.
Well, you know what they call that on Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark? They call that pre-production.
Right. One of the producers blamed an accident. There was another accident on the show a few weeks ago. And he said, oh, all that bad press, people stayed away. I'm like, really? If anything, it reminded people the show was still on. I mean, not to belittle the serious injury to the person involved, but I don't think that stopped the box office. I don't think it barely registered with people.
Well, let me ask you this. What stopped the box office on this Hal Prince review?
Well, it never got off the ground. The New York Times had a story about this Hal Prince review. It was one of the shows I think we talked about at the beginning of the year. Would you invest in it? And I think I said yes.
So let me get this straight. You're not investing in the shows that are profitable. You are investing in the shows that effectively never
opened.
I
think my picks overall were okay. The shows that I did invest in, I think most of them I made money. So I think we'll be all right.
All right.
You're going to have to be right once or twice to make a lot of money. But anyway, this Hal Prince review never got out of the gate. It's a review around Hal Prince, one of the most famous directors in Broadway history. He has 21 Tonys, more than any other individual ever. He's made shows like Cabaret, Evita, Phantom of the Opera, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, revivals of Showboat and Candide, and of course, a bunch of musicals with Stephen Sondheim. They said, hey, let's do a show like that Bob Fosse show or some other shows and do a tribute to Hal Prince. You can do the greatest hits from all these big shows. A big hit from Cabaret, a big hit from Showboat, a big hit from Phantom of the Opera. What could go wrong?
Everything.
Well, they never got it off the ground. And there's some reasons why it's not a good idea to invest in reviews. And the Times broke it down. Number one, reviews don't sell.
Ah, okay.
You know, it's hard to
sell. I would imagine the budget was pretty high, though.
The budget was $13 million. Yeah. That's what they suggested it would cost to mount the show, which is not unreasonable for a big Broadway musical like this would be, but it's a lot of money. The Times also said they started with the wrong producer, Aubrey Dan. Hollywood is a really tight, insular community. And Aubrey
Hollywood,
Dan is,
don't you mean Broadway?
What? Yeah, Broadway is the really tight insular community. And Aubrey Dan is the son of a Canadian billionaire, and he has no big ties to theater world. So he's starting, you know, from like 10 paces behind the starting line because he doesn't know everybody. He doesn't have the connections. He hasn't been working there for years. It's a really hard place to break into. And even if a review works, it doesn't make a lot of money because you got to pay off all the songwriters and all the people from all these other shows. You want to send in the clowns in your show? It's going to cost you.
You know, he could have learned all of this just by watching Smash.
you want to use the music of the night from the Phantom of the Opera? That's going to cost you. So, you know, that adds to your weekly revenue nut, you know, the nut, the amount of cost it is every week. You may make a lot of money, but a lot of it gets pulled out by all these other people. So this show's really struggled. It was set for 2012. Then it was supposed to come out this fall. Now it's going to open in Japan in 2015 and maybe come to Broadway in early 2016 if they could raise the money. You know, it's not easy. And if you want to see Aubrey Dan, has he been sort of battered around here by Broadway? Does he feel a little beleaguered? Yes, he does.
Listen to this quote. I love this quote.
Read it out. I love it.
He says, and this is a quote, if Hal Prince wants his story on Broadway right now, he can write the check. And he has more than enough money to do that. And if he does, it will be a huge seller. But does he have the guts to do it?
Spoken like a man who doesn't want to work in Broadway anymore.
Yeah, well, I think he probably is kind of going, you know what, guys? Have at it. Good luck with this theater thing.
So Broadway's complicated. There's a lot of things that go into whether a show works or not. The rights, the issues, the songs. How expensive is it? How many people get a cut before you get to have profits? You got to look at all that stuff. So I've learned something. I wonder what it'll be like to make American Psycho, because that's a musical, bizarrely enough.
Now, this is the Bret Easton Ellis book turned into a movie, of course.
Starring Christian Bale.
Yes. And the book was very controversial at the time, not only for being potentially or possibly not that good, but some of the violent acts that occurred in it.
Well, it was a very violent novel, yes.
Yes.
And it had lots of, you know, satirical elements that really came across in the film adaptation, starring Christian Bale. The movie was better reviewed than the book was, I would say.
I would agree.
I wouldn't say it was a across the board well reviewed movie, but it was certainly, you know, much better than the book. The book was really sort of, you know, people were not sure what to make of it. The film was directed by Mary Harron and had a lot of success, and I think sort of revived the reputation of the book.
I would agree. I mean, and also I think time revived the reputation of the book, because he really was, and this is Bret Easton Ellis, the author, was writing about a character in that late 80s, early 90s kind of Wall Street excess, becoming a serial killer.
Yeah. I mean, I read it. I didn't think it was good. And I liked Less Than Zero. He's certainly been an author of diminishing returns. I'm not sold that the book is good. I thought the movie was better than the book. I don't think that the book is an undiscovered classic, but people are fascinated by it. And now it's becoming a musical of all things. It's the next project by Duncan Sheik, who came to Broadway with the Tony-winning musical Spring Awakening. He's a terrific, you know, singer-songwriter. I've interviewed him. I really like the guy. I think he's really talented. It's going to open in London, not New York. And it's going to star, get this, who will it star?
Christian Bale.
No, Doctor Who. Matt Smith, the current Doctor, is going to be playing, what's his name? Patrick Bateman. In American Psycho, when it opens in London at the Alameda. Bizarre. He really wants to put Doctor Who behind him. I want to kill people. And there could be family-friendly Doctor Who to the musical version of American Psycho. That's as quick a turnaround as you could ask for. And to me, you know, I immediately went, wow, a British guy to play Patrick Bateman? But let's not forget, Christian Bale was Welsh. He played him in the movie, so what's the big deal?
Ooh, I know you're trying to move us on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, but let me ask you this. Do you think the closing of the New York City Opera, and I guess it's what, after 70 years, this was the opera that was founded by Fiorella LaGuardia, the airport. Or no, I'm sorry, that's the mayor that the airport was named after.
That's right.
He built this or created this opera for the people. That's what it was there for. And for years, they were in Lincoln Center. And then I guess they couldn't afford to be in Lincoln Center anymore. And they were the competitor or the sister opera to the Met, which is also there in Lincoln Center. They filed for bankruptcy. They are closing. Did you get to see Anna Nicole, the opera, Mark Anthony Turnage's opera, before they closed?
No, I didn't. I mean, it was at BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and that's part of the problem. I mean, if you'd ask me, is this a big deal or a big whoop? I'd say it's a big whoop, because they've fallen so far that they're barely a force anymore. They'd have a couple shows at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and that would be their whole season. You know, they have like a limited run of a few shows. It felt like not even a presence anymore in the city. They always felt overshadowed by the Met, and they left Lincoln Center, and they should not have done that, and everything fell apart after that. They were just doing new shows. They just had a few shows a season. They had no regular presence. They couldn't pay their orchestra regularly. It felt more like a subscription service than an actual living, vibrant organization that was there all the time, and the bottom just fell out under. It's very, very sad. You know, I've saw shows at New York City Opera over the years. And I don't know, it was founded by LaGuardia, and he certainly encouraged it. It was founded, you know,
Mayor Bloomberg was also kind of a big contributor.
It was long before. I mean, he was mayor when it came into existence in 1943, I think it was. So I'm sure he encouraged it and helped make it happen, but I don't think he founded it. He was the mayor at the time. But nonetheless, you know, it's a sad loss. I mean, tell you how sad it is. They had a $7 million Kickstarter campaign to try and raise some money for the opera. And some of the board members weren't even sure what Kickstarter was. I mean, you know, it's probably more like 70 years old. So like, what? You want to go online and beg for money?
Which is why, I mean, that kind of campaign failed, because they had no idea what they were doing with this campaign. And they did a $7 million campaign. Okay. First off, I don't know if there's ever been a campaign that has asked to... I think there have been a few.
Well, campaigns. The video game, wasn't that like up to $13 million or something?
Yeah, no, yeah. Certainly they can earn that much, but you don't ask for it outright. You hope that you get that high. But
that's just a sign of how desperate they were.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
They had the high visibility of Lincoln Center. They walked away. They had contentious fights with the unions over salary and payment. They lost their visibility, their presence in the city landscape, and now that they're closing... It's very sad, but you almost won't even notice it. And that's a real shame.
And I think that's a classic example of bad management, and how when you actually start to shrink your product, you publish less issues per year of your magazine, or you have fewer performances, it's really hard to make money when you're actually shrinking your product.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So, but you
that's why we have so much lengthy episodes.
That's right.
That's why we just have extra episode all the time.
We're trying to increase our product. That you're right. Absolutely correct, Michael. But now you thought that story was a big whoop. Let's see if I can interest you in any of these stories that we have in Big Deal or Big Whoop this week. Of course, Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. If you thought David Letterman would call it quits around the same time as Jay Leno, you just don't know late night. The chance to be the grand old man and stay on the air when Leno was gone? And who knows, even reclaim the number one spot as Kimmel and Fallon battle it out over the kiddies? Of course he's going to take that. It proved too much to resist for Letterman, who signed on through now 2015, his new contract is for. That will mark 33 years in late night, a record surpassing Johnny Carson's 30 years. Letterman will be 68 years old. But will he be number one? That is the question. And is this a big deal or a big whoop? That is another question.
Well, I think it's a big whoop because I can't imagine him walking away when Leno was just leaving. The idea that he would leave at the same time. People talked about, oh, he's in contract negotiations. Maybe he'll retire. I thought, you're out of your mind. The chance for Leno to be gone and Letterman still to be standing, still there, that to me was, you know, too sweet to pass up.
Well, here is a story that's probably right in your wheelhouse, Michael. Goodreads faced a lot of flack for a recent decision about reviews on its site. The company decided that reviews which attacked authors for various reasons, so kind of trollish on the authors, and these reviews, I guess they focused on the author rather than focusing on the book itself, they would not be allowed. They summarily deleted all such reviews from their site. Some members complained Goodreads was putting publishers ahead of book fans. Others said their decision was draconian, which is actually a condition that you get when you go to Transylvania and you get bitten. Oh, never mind. Just like Netflix, with its bungled splitting of services into two, remember there was the DVD and the streaming, Goodreads is apologizing, they're saying sorry, but staying the course. They did acknowledge that readers deserved access to the content they'd created, so they're retrieving all the deleted text and emailing it to the individual members.
What a nightmare.
Yeah, I would not want that job, that's for sure. In the future, when they delete a review, the text will be automatically sent to the person who authored it. Still, the practice of deletion will go on. It will continue. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. Okay. I think it was somebody called it growing pains. It said, transitioning from being a niche site into something larger. I'm like, transitioning? They have 20 million users. You know, they've been big for quite a while. But it was a growing problem of like readers attacking authors and authors attacking readers and people attacking each other. And they just said, hey, you know what? We want to have a civil site where people are polite to each other and talk and read about books, not about this author doesn't do, you know, author interviews or he doesn't offer his ebooks free or whatever their complaint was. They just wanted to get away from all these personal attacks and have it focused on the books. And I thought it was a reasonable choice. They did it poorly. But they've recovered and they said, you're right, we did it poorly. And they're doing a better job of it now by sending people the content they created. I think that's a good step to do. They'll want to tweak their policy as it goes along. But I think in a very broad sense, it's fairly reasonable. You've got a review of a book and it's attacking the author and the person hasn't read the book. Well, that's not fair. And their site depends on that. It's not like Amazon where it's the Wild West. They really want to make sure that people are focused on the book and have read the book and are talking about the book, rather than some extraneous issue.
And Goodreads is owned by Amazon, we should point out.
Yeah, it is now. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, really, YouTube did this recently, figured out a way to tweak the comment system that they had, and instead of, so you could vote down comments, so that people who are kind of trollish, that you could just say, you know what, let's not give them any credence. Let's vote them down.
Let's not give them oxygen. Yeah, it's hard to do. You want it to be sort of self-policing like that. That's a good way of doing it, to hopefully that the crowd will maintain civility, right. You know, somebody talking about, oh, try out my health diet plan. You know, it's nice if you can have 20 readers click in and say, delete, delete, delete. And then it ends up getting, you know, taken off because people say it's not germane. So, you know, it's hard to do. It's a big, big world out there. Everybody can comment. It's really hard to police those comments. And I think it's something that you got to do to maintain a certain civility and a certain usefulness to your readers.
That's why we ask everybody to come and, place those comments on our website.
That's right.
Yeah, showbizsandbox.com, by the way, in case you're
wondering. Fight-free website.
Yes. Now, let's stick with books for a second, because we told you a few weeks ago about Oyster. Oyster is the Netflix-style subscription service for book lovers. Well, it's got some competition. Scribd just launched, and like Oyster, the one major publisher it has a deal with is HarperCollins. But where Oyster had just a smattering of new releases, Scribd apparently has the majority of HarperCollins. every book they've ever published through mid-2012. They also have deals with a slew of top indies, and these are indie publishers. Their focus is on backlist instead of new releases. They cost $9 a month, and their app is available not just on iPhones, like Oyster, but on all smartphones. So tablet and laptop devices, you know, I'm sure at some point the desktop. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
No, it's available everywhere right now. So it's just,
okay.
I think it's a big deal in a sense. There's got to be competition. One of these people is going to work. So the more people, the merrier. It makes a lot more sense to launch with your app on all smartphones and tablets and laptop devices and not just an iPhone. I thought that was ridiculous. But it's kind of a funky little thing, isn't it? Because Scribd has been around for a while, hasn't it?
Yes, they are known for being a web service where you can upload documents, so PDFs.
So like Google Doc?
Well, yes and no. I mean, basically, these are usually completed documents. It's Google Docs, you're actually there to work on a document or to write text. Here, Scribd is saying, look, you have a catalog you want to post it on Scribd. You have a speech that you have typed out on a Microsoft Word document, upload it, and you can share.
So it's like a YouTube for documents.
Yes, exactly. You did a much better job in like three or four words than I did in like three or four sentences in describing what Scribd is. They have a competitor called DocStock. It's like SlideShare where you can upload presentations. So SlideShare is like a YouTube for PowerPoint presentations. It's similar. And basically what they're saying is, hey, look, this is just content management here at Scribd. That's all we're doing. So you know what? We may as well manage all these text documents. We may as well manage books.
It's a logical extension of what they do. Do they have a database where they interface with readers a lot? Or it's like they've done a good job in their app or, you know?
I don't know. Yes. I mean, basically, it's a way to discover certain documents. So yeah, they have a discovery engine. Mm-hmm. And you can follow certain people. Like I follow Alamo Drafthouse for some reason. And whenever they publish something, I get a little email.
Well, I have no opinion on Scribd versus Oyster or anyone else, but I think this will work. Two things that Scribd has going for them is one, that the backlist is where publishers love to make money. They've got all these thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of books that they've printed. That's where they traditionally made a lot of their regular cash. You know, the revenue flowing from those old copies of John Irving novels and Stephen King novels, that was their bread and butter. You know, new books came out, but baby, the backlist was where they really raked in the dough. So the fact that Scribd is focused on backlist is really good for publishers. It's kind of like a classic TV show like MASH or Seinfeld. Those make money for you forever. Syndication, DVD, you name it. Same thing with books that have been out for a while. Similarly, Scribd is offering a lot of data to publishers, and they love that as well. They're going to give them a lot of info on the readers and what they're reading and what they're doing. So that sort of back and forth is very valuable to the publishers. They don't have that good information. So if Scribd is able to make that available to them and it's useful to them, then publishers will want to work with them.
Well, our next story is one we've talked about before because, yes, indeed, DVRs matter. The numbers are in for the live plus three DVR figures, and as expected, many shows benefited. NBC won the premiere week in a big way in the 18 to 49-year-old demographic that we love to harp on, and that margin of victory was held up once DVR numbers were factored in. So they kind of won live, and they won live plus three. It did better than ABC in that demo, its closest competitor, by 35%, a huge margin of victory, and the largest since 1997, some 16 years ago. By and large, we're seeing a consistent pattern early on. The percentages can get confusing. This show increased 37%, while the other show increased 64%. But basically, the better a show did in its overnight numbers, the better it did in DVR watchers. So that's kind of a nice little guideline. The shows that are in a very competitive time slot that might benefit enormously from DVRs hasn't popped up quite yet. I don't think that's actually occurred yet. If people watched you live, chances are you'll solidify that success on DVR. Furthermore, the networks have to wait till mid-October to get the live plus seven figures, so we're still waiting for those figures to come in. Those don't count for advertisers, by the way, but they do count for bragging rights about how big a show's audience really is, and in the end of your rankings, of course. So are DVRs a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? I think I know the answer to this. Should we just move right along to the next entry?
We can move right along. It's like, obviously, it's a big deal. Obviously, the audience increases dramatically. NBC's win is even bigger now once you factor in all the DVR numbers. The fact that we have to wait a month to find out how well they actually did, that to me is crazy. But that's the world we live in right now. And that won't even include people who watch it online and elsewhere.
Hey, it's show business. The whole industry's crazy. In fact, speaking of crazy, Michael Jackson's estate didn't accuse the concert-promoting company AEG Live, that's the concert promoter, with killing the pop superstar, but they certainly came close. A civil trial revolved around the question of who exactly hired Dr. Conrad Murray at $150,000 a month. Murray is the doctor who treated Jackson, gave him a drug typically used for anesthesia just to help the star go to sleep, and is now serving jail time for involuntary manslaughter. The family said AEG Live hired Murray and ruthlessly went after profits at the expense of Jackson's life. The promoters, on the other hand, said Jackson was a celebrity addict who deceived everyone around him and shopped for doctors who would give him what he wanted. The jury decided AEG Live was not responsible for his death and thus was not liable to pay the family for loss of income, an amount that would easily have reached hundreds of millions and possibly even $1 billion or more. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
If you're with AEG Live, it's a big deal. Anybody else, it's a big whoop. You know, it's the family had a really hard argument to make. They wanted to say he was so ill he could barely perform, but then they also wanted to turn around and say, but he would have been performing tons of concerts for the rest of his life and therefore would have made so much money. It's like, well, if he's so ill he can't perform, you know, it wasn't a temporary illness. It seemed to be a debilitating condition he's had for years now. It just, you know, it just got very complicated. And the idea of personal responsibility, the idea that this guy was only going to accept the doctor he wanted, who was going to give him what he wanted, was pretty compelling, I thought.
Yeah, you know, I agree. And I think that what AEG Live was saying is, yes, we were paying him. We were paying him $150,000 a month.
Well, he's not our doctor. He's his doctor, right, and he chose him.
Yeah, and we were paying Michael Jackson's assistants, and we were paying, you know, it's very common that when an actor or an actress or a director gets on a film or a television show, there are certain things the production company pays for, one of which is the assistant at the time.
But a doctor for $150,000 a month to be on call, a nice job.
Yes, it is. It's a lot of people in the medical field felt that that was criminal enough. Now, here's a follow-up from a story that we mentioned last week. You might recall, we mentioned the NBC Hillary Clinton miniseries is dead. The CNN documentary on Hillary Clinton is also dead. Fox News is thrilled. On the other hand, yet another documentary about Hillary is moving forward. Fox News is still thrilled. Why? Because this documentary isn't from an established news outlet like CNN. It's from the conservative organization Citizens United, which went to the Supreme Court over its 2008 documentary about Clinton. The nine justices ruled at the time that blocking the airing of this two-hour film on TV stations amounted to an unconstitutional breach of free speech. And this is a quote, "This is why I went to the Supreme Court." And this was a quote from David, I don't know how you pronounce his name, David Bossie. I guess he's the head of Citizens United. And that's what he said to The Hollywood Reporter. He went on to say, "Now that I won that case, I can do whatever I want with this new movie. I can advertise it on radio and TV, show it on TV whenever I want to. All the things they stopped us from doing with Hillary, the movie." That was his previous movie. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal because, you know, it'll be part of the election cycle. It'll be something to deal with. It's kind of ironic. You know, like, people don't want the political parties were worried about having established news outlets with track records for making TV movies and miniseries, but they're happy to have third-party people who can just shoot off at the mouth do it. You know, they don't want NBC and CNN, but they do want Michael Moore and Citizens United.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
I'm not going to equate Michael Moore's with their, you know, factual distortions, but you get my point. To people on the right, Michael Moore is what people on the left consider David Bossie. So it's like, well, make up your mind. Why would you object to having an established news outlet like CNN make a responsible documentary? And yet, you're like, great, I'm glad that these third-party, you know, firebrands are willing to do it. It seems like you'd want all of them, at least.
Right. And to me, what's interesting about this story is it reminds people of how that whole Citizens United ruling came down, that it was actually over a documentary. I don't think a lot of people understand that.
Well, documentary is a kind word. But yeah, so this is the Citizens United is the rule that says anybody can spend any money they want on elections.
As long as they're not working directly for one of the candidates.
So whether you're George Soros or the Koch brothers, you can just go nuts, spend $1 billion, try to influence the election.
That's right.
And that's the world we live in now. And it's all because the FCC blocked the Hillary the movie from being shown on local TV stations right before a Democratic primary.
Right, exactly.
Good Lord.
And it really had a whole lot of unintended consequences, that's for sure. And many of which with the super PACs our friend Stephen Colbert tried to point out on his show.
That's right.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. Do you see how I'm trying to keep the show on track here?
I do.
Okay, well, Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And really, these stories that we're about to talk about really do have the entertainment industry buzzing because they're all about the insiders that run the entertainment industry, specifically the film industry, specifically movie studios.
That's right. I originally had a small story about Sony firing their marketing guy after the studio had what they considered a poor summer. This was the summer where they had some bombs like After Earth and The Great Gatsby and White House Down.
Right.
But Hollywood Reporter pointed out, you know what? There's been an almost entire regime change at almost every major studio. It's been a huge upheaval throughout Hollywood. And they went over to talk about it, and they called it the season of the, what did they call it?
Season of the witch hunt.
Yeah. And they said, what's going on here? So Sperling, tell us, recap for us, what's been going on at the big studio executive offices over the last year, year and a half?
Well, I'd like to take us all the way back to 2012. I don't know why I'm saying that like I'm a newsreader.
Neither do I.
So yeah, beginning in 2012, early, Disney chairman, he was, you know, from Disney, I guess the Disney network, the Disney Channel. He was made head of this is Rich Ross we're talking about. He was made head of the film division, not knowing much about the film industry. And John Carter was the result. And of course, Rich Ross being let go was also the result of that. Then you had
Disney fired their head in early 2012.
Right. And they eventually got Alan Horn, who was let go by Warner Brothers. They basically kind of did away with him, with Alan Horn, who had been there for like, I don't know, 15 years at Warner Brothers. Alan Horn eventually moved to Disney to replace Rich Ross. Meanwhile, you have Tom Rothman, who's working with Jim Giannopoulos as the heads of Fox, the 20th Century Fox film division. And they kept Jim Giannopoulos, who was always said to be, oh, he's the business guy. Tom Rothman is the creative guy. They showed Tom Rothman the door. They kind of pushed him out.
So Disney fired their boss, brought in a guy from Warner Brothers after he was kicked out. And Fox had two people in charge, and one of them was shown the door.
Right.
So what happened at Warner Brothers where Alan Horn was shoved out the door? What happened to him?
Well,
I mean, what happened to Warner Brothers?
Jeff Bukes said, you know what we're going to do here? We have three big divisions. We have television, home video, and film. Let's have a big bake-off in 2012 and see which of these executives should be the new CEO.
Who won?
Well, Kevin Sugihara, who was the head of, I guess, home video and home entertainment, won. So
remember the years when nobody would pay attention to DVD? And
yes,
now suddenly that guy became the head of the studio.
That's right. I do. Heck, back in the mid-90s, I was a creative artist agency trying and pleading with the folks at CAA to try and get the inventors of DVD into the agency to kind of give a presentation on what DVD was and how it was so much better than videotape and VHS.
And Laserdisc.
And Laserdisc even, which I was a big fan of. And nobody was interested. None of the agents wanted to come and see this presentation. So I had to keep going back to these engineers and saying, yeah, no, guys, sorry, they don't want to hear anything about DVD. And now the head of DVD, the head of home entertainment over at Warner Brothers, is the head of the entire company.
And who did he beat out and what happened to them?
Well, Bruce Rosenbloom was the head of TV, and he kind of almost immediately left. He was basically like, nope, I'm out of here. And Jeff Robinoff was the head of film, and he'd been the head of film in that division for, I don't know, another 12 or 13 years. He'd been there for a while, and he worked his way up, and now he's gone. It took a while to work out his exit strategy, but he's gone, and everybody thinks he's going to go over and work with Jim Giannopoulos. I don't know how true that is, whether he's going to move to Fox, but Jeff Robinoff is considered a really good executive, one who oversaw all the Batman franchises, the Harry Potter franchises. Alan Horn also helped with that, but a lot of insiders are saying, look, we thought Kevin Sugihara coming in, having no film experience, film industry experience, that could be shaky. But, you know, industry-wide, people are saying he put this team of three different executives in charge from different areas of the company. And everybody's saying very little has changed at Warner Brothers. It's still running smoothly. So the regime changed, worked. And guess what? Sugihara was actually able to convince J.K. Rowling to do these spinoffs.
That's right. She gave him full credit for that. So at Disney, they got rid of one guy and brought in a new one. At Fox, they cut their leadership in half at Warner Brothers, they kicked their guy out and they had a bake-off and got rid of a bunch of executives. And now they have a new guy in charge. That has to make people at the other studios a little nervous, especially at Sony, where they had a bad summer, as we started to talk about. They had flops like The Great Gatsby right before summer happened and White House Down and After Earth. So they're nervous. They're seeing all these changes at other studios going on. What did the top executives at Sony do?
They immediately said, it's not our fault. It's Mark Weinstock's fault. Mark Weinstock is in charge of marketing. And Mark Weinstock was summarily executed. No, he was.
So they fired one of the lower level people to try.
Well, he wasn't lower level. He was in charge of.
He was the head of marketing. Right. But I'm saying he's not the head of the studio.
No.
And so the head of the studio said, let's go over to him and give his head on a platter. So maybe they won't fire us. Is that our argument?
I don't know if that's necessarily true. Again, I always think that there's usually some insider things going on that either are known only to that company or known in the industry, or they're known to the broader world. In this case, I think this is an instance where only people in Sony understand why Mark was...
They had a bad summer.
They had a bad summer, but you can't blame that on that Mark Weinstock.
But look at the movies they put out.
Exactly.
After Earth, The Great Gatsby, Grown Ups 2, Smurfs 2, Elysium, One Direction, and This is the End. Now, several of those actually made money. This is the End made a lot of money. Grown Ups 2 tripled its budget. Smurfs 2 tripled its budget. One Direction made a lot of money. It only cost $10 million to make. So if you look at most of them had bad reviews. So if you look at the movies he got and what he got out of them, he actually had a pretty good summer.
Yeah.
He had eight movies and seven of them got bad to horrible reviews, and he turned five of them into moneymakers. He doubled the budget of one, tripled the budget of two, quadrupled the budget of a fourth, and whatever it is that they did with One Direction.
I'm not disagreeing with you that I think he is definitely, at least outwardly, the fall guy for their
he should have gotten a raise.
Well, Steve Elzer, who was for years the studio Sony's big, you know, head of PR, was also he's not being pushed out. He says he's leaving at the end of the year. He's going to be done. Mm-hmm. So, and he was like, you know, they call it the studio mouthpiece. So he's leaving. You know, the only studio that's really has nothing going on is Paramount.
Because?
Well, I think that's because a lot of people that I like the way the Hollywood Reporter puts it, that what happens after Sumner Redstone may prove mortal and actually pass away is one of Hollywood's big parlor games. And I would agree with that. I think a lot of people are just kind of saying, well, you know, that's the regime that's there now. But
it's stable because he's in charge and he's happy with the people doing their job.
Right. But, you know, you
make it sound like they're waiting for him to die. They're not waiting for him to die. He's in charge. If he was not happy, they'd be out.
Oh, that is. I think he has proven that time and again, no matter how old he is.
So what's going on here, Sperling? Is this some sort of just alignment of the planets and all these people happen to be kicked out at the same time?
Before I answer that, we shouldn't, because we're going to be chastised. I know we'll get a few emails for not mentioning Universal and what just happened over there with Adam Fogelson being kicked out and Ron Meyer, that is now the head of the studio and the head of NBC, chairman Donna
Lang. There was a regime change at Universal as well.
Right, but also at Focus Features, which James Sheamus...
Wow. That's tiny. I mean, who cares?
Well, a lot of people care.
Well, yeah, of course. But I mean, you know, I don't care about the Home and Garden Channel if I'm talking about who got replaced at NBC, CBS, ABC, and Fox.
Is the Home and Garden Channel part of either? Well, maybe. I don't know.
Focus Features, of course. Why was he fired abruptly?
Well, Donna Langley, now the head of one of the heads of film over at Universal Pictures. And I guess Focus Features falls underneath Universal Pictures, and she wants to go with more commercial work. So she's bringing in somebody from Film District, Peter Schlechel.
What studio doesn't want to go with commercial work?
Well, I mean,
what studio says let's make non-commercial fare?
Well, she wants to go with less the prestige kind of art house fare.
Uh-huh.
And James Sheamus, known as, you know, one of the nice guys in Hollywood, and, you know, he was responsible for Brokeback Mountain and lots of other films. They're saying, you know, it's great and all, but they don't make a lot of money, and we want a broader audience. And so he's going to go and work on Ang Lee's next film. He's worked with Ang Lee quite a bit over the years. He wrote The Ice Storm. He wrote, did he write Brokeback Mountain? I don't think he wrote Brokeback Mountain. I think Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon he wrote. So I guess Ang Lee is doing this 3D boxing epic, and he's going to go work on that and produce other films. He was a part of 50 Shades of Grey, which, according to some insiders, he was arguing about with Donna Langley.
Oh, they weren't on the same page as far as casting or something like that?
I have no idea, but some say that could not have helped.
If you look at the list of Focus Features movies over the 2010s, you don't see a lot of breakout stuff or even big Oscar winners. You have Hyde Park on Hudson and Anna Karenina and Promised Land, the Matt Damon film, which has sort of collapsed, The Place Beyond the Pines. You know, you have to go back to Moonrise.
You also have The Kids Are All Right, Moonrise Kingdom. And you know,
that's right. That's way at the beginning of 2010. I didn't say he didn't have any success stories. I'm just saying you've had quite a while. You've had 2 years now where he hasn't really had a lot of success. You've had some critical success, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Moonrise Kingdom. Those were good, solid hits, I think.
But they don't make a lot of money, I guess. And I would agree.
Well, but that's what a specialty label's for.
That's right.
Right? But he hasn't even had the prestige as much. You look at from Moonrise Kingdom on, it's been pretty balmy. You know,
yes.
So if you've got a year or year and a half of poor track record, that's the time they start to show you the door, isn't it?
I guess so. I mean, I would assume so, but I think also this was just, she's making her mark. Donna Langley is, you know.
She wants to hire her own people. So what's going on? Is it just the natural cycle of, you know, studio overturn, or is there something different happening?
That was your original question, wasn't it? Well, I think a couple things. Studios are now being run by these big corporations, like Comcast, for instance, like Sony.
And well, that's been going on for decades.
Yeah, but Gulf and Western, I don't think you can compare Gulf and Western to Comcast.
Why not?
Gulf and Western Whatever.
Big companies have owned Hollywood since the 70s, at least, right?
Yes.
Right.
They've become much bigger.
This is not a new phenomenon. So, but this last year, we've suddenly had a big turnover in executives. What's going on? It's not because big corporations are suddenly involved. They've been around for decades.
Well, they're much bigger, as are the budgets a lot of these films. They're making a lot of sequels. The pressure on these executives, you know, is immense. It's one thing when you make, you know, $10 to $20 million movies and one or two fail or three fail. It's another when you make one giant $250 to $300 million movie and you have to write off $190 million.
So the stakes are higher.
The stakes are much, much higher. The big problem that they're going to have is there's not going to be a huge crop of executive talent because they keep churning through all of these. And frankly, nobody's...
Well, don't they just go somewhere else and then they come back again?
Well, they usually go off to become producers.
Well, Alan Horn, he went from Warner... You know, I mean, James Sheamus could end up somewhere else again, right?
Yeah, well, he founded Focus in the first place.
Right.
So, yes, he could very easily go off and become, you know...
They don't disappear.
That's right. They don't disappear. I think there's very little movement in the lower executive ranks. So that... It'll be interesting to see what happens over time. I think a lot of the pressure is also coming from outside forces, such as all these co-financiers, like Legendary and now Dune over at Warner Brothers. You know, when you're spreading the risk around like that, you have to start answering to people outside of just your corporate boss, say Comcast or Viacom, but you have to answer to Wall Street and investors and all these investment companies that come in and put money into your films.
Well, these movies cost a lot more to make, but they make a lot more. Isn't the pie a lot bigger? So, I mean, you're spending $200 million rather than $80 million, but you're making $1 billion rather than $300 million.
Well,
you know what I mean?
That's
I know
what everybody's
stakes are
going
bigger,
for.
But the rewards are bigger too, right?
Right. They're all trying to hit the grand slam, and when you miss big time.
So, who made the best move of all these moves in the last year and a half? Which studio look and go, that was a smart move? I think that's the best move. That's the best management in charge right now.
Oh, well, okay, Disney. Alan Horn is very experienced in that world.
You're just an old fuddy-duddy, aren't you? Going with the safe, familiar, because he's been around for decades, therefore he must be good.
Fox, because they kept one person on who has been there. They have some consistency.
Can I make you change your mind every time?
No.
Well, that makes sense, but, you know, Disney is... And Alan Horn is, you know, he's certainly got the track record, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Can't fault you. I mean, it's a no-brainer decision, that's for sure.
Well, he's got a good track record, but our track record on facts, you know, we may not always get it right, but we're always happy to correct ourselves, aren't we?
Yes, that is true. And thankfully, we have Joe Gaze to correct us this week. He wrote into us after we started talking about the highest grossing foreign language films in the United States. And I guess we had a whole bunch of films on there, and we were talking about Instructions Not Included being the highest grossing Spanish language film on the list.
Right. And we said that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is the highest grossing foreign language film in North America of all time, with over $100 million at the North American box office. Well, as Joe points out, we're kind of wrong.
That's right. He says, I am not sure how Aramaic, Latin, and Hebrew are not foreign languages, but The Passion of the Christ grossed $370 million, and actually more than that, but $370 million in the United States and $611 plus million, almost $612 million worldwide. So wouldn't this be the number one foreign language film? and he has a link to Box Office Mojo's entry for Passion of the Christ. That's from Joe Gaze from Wilmington, Delaware. And I'd have to say that
he writes, P.S. By the way, I love the show. It is the one podcast my wife enjoys with me. We're keeping marriages together, Sperling.
That's true. Please write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com with your correspondence.
With your romantic success stories. Our first date, we went and listened to Showbiz Sandbox. Well, he makes a great point. I went back and looked at some of the articles. Some of them do not clarify. If you look up the list on Mojo, however, where he got his box of information for Passion of the Christ, they make the qualification when they list their highest grossing films of all time, foreign language, they say they do not count. They say only overseas produced features counted. Reissues okay. excluded. To which I say, why?
Well, you know, I would agree with that.
And produced just creates a nightmare, a hornet's nest of problems to try and figure out what's a co-production, what counts as French rather than Spanish, rather than American, rather than Russian. You know, it's just, why deal with it? If it's not in English, why not count that? Because that's about the only movie I can think of that would fall into this loophole, right?
Well, not the only movie.
No, but that's this high grossing.
Possibly, yes.
I can think of is, are there some Canadian films? I mean, no, what do they mean by overseas?
Lots of Miramax films would fall into this, where Miramax paid for it, so it becomes...
No. Overseas produced. No, you're conflating. I'm saying for the ones that they... there's none that they excluded. They maybe should have, but...
I don't know, but this is a problem with the Academy Awards, too. They will not allow a foreign language film in that was... So Passion of the Christ could not be allowed into Best Foreign Language Feature category
right.
because of this that ruling.
But that's a different issue. That's an award they want to hand out. If you're talking about box office grosses, just say, what language is it in? If it's not in English, make a list.
Yeah, and with all these co-productions, I agree, especially Hollywood. You know, you ask Hollywood these days, you know what they say? Yeah, we're all Chinese co-productions.
Exactly. But that's great of him to point it out. We should have caught it ourselves and called the other people out on it. So I appreciate him reminding us of that, about Passion of the Christ, and perhaps some other films, like there may be some Canadian features that are on that list that deserve to be.
I agree. In fact, again, he wrote to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-7263. Again, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts out for free. Please do rate and review the show in any of those podcast aggregators. It really does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website. That is showbizsandbox.com. Now, that's also where you'll find all those ways to subscribe or to contact us or to follow us. Again, we're on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our username. We're also on Facebook. Look up Showbiz Sandbox and you can like us there. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, on their website, whoismgmt.com. And tonight they're not playing, but tomorrow they're going to be in Paris, France at the Olympia. And on Wednesday, they're going
to
be...
Don't you have to say the date?
October 8th, Paris, France. October cool. 9th, Hamburg, Germany. So go out and see MGMT. Go out and rate, review Showbiz Sandbox. And definitely visit one of Michael's websites, which is...
DavidLettermanIsGod.com.
Wow. Well, if you can't find any of his work on that particular website, you might want to check out MichaelGiltz.com. For some of my writing, you can find it on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week. Play nice. Hi, everyone. This is Sperling again. Thanks for listening to this week's show. I just wanted to remind all our listeners to please help Showbiz Sandbox be a part of the 2013 Podcast Awards by visiting podcastawards.com and casting your nomination for our show. We cannot do it without your help. Once again, that website is podcastawards.com, and you can enter Showbiz Sandbox in two categories, the People's Choice category and Entertainment category. Thanks for all your continued support.